America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome back to America Trends. You may have been on the dance floor at a wedding when you heard in song the cry of the future of the automobile industry. It's electric. Whether you've mastered the electric slide or not, you may be sliding into the driver's seat of an all-electric vehicle a lot sooner than you had imagined. On the heels of California's executive order to end the sale of new gas-burning cars in that state in 15 years, major car companies like General Motors say they plan to discontinue making the internal combustion engine over that period too. What does all this mean to you and the way you drive? Will the costs go up to own a vehicle? And can the electrical grid sustain what's coming? So many questions. So we went to a man with many of the answers. He's next on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is John Axon. He's an associate professor in the area of resource and environmental management at the Simon Fraser University. And that's way up in British Columbia in Canada. And he's a specialist really in understanding how it is that we can mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. And I brought him here primarily to talk about electric cars. And we're wondering, John, how far in the offing are these electric cars in terms of being practical, in terms of being on the road where we see them routinely? Because California, as you know, has just put forward this executive order and saying that they're not going to be selling the regular gas-burning cars as of 2035. I don't know if that's a law or just a goal.
Well, to start with, that California policy of having a ban of internal combustion engines by 2035, if it's not already a law, it will be turned into a law. California is quite serious about their GHG targets. And they already have the framework in place. Their zero emissions vehicle mandate requires a certain percentage market share of electric vehicles be sold in each year. And so this ban essentially is just kind of like wrapping up that requirement to 100% requirement for zero emissions vehicles by 2035.
And how important is whatever California does? We always say it starts in California and then goes east, at least across the lower part of North America. Is it likely that this will, because of the power of that market, really influence car makers to hurry up a bit?
Sure. Well, I mean, it helps inspire a lot of other jurisdictions. And the more I've done collaborative work with policymakers in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe, it really helps that those policymakers can point to California and say, hey, you know, there is a forward-looking market and they have this policy in place. So, you know, why wouldn't we want to catch up with them and be an innovator like they are? So that definitely helps. And I think a related part of your question is, you know, do automakers care? Let's say if it's a population of something like 40 million people, is that big enough for them to start changing their strategies for how they invest in research and development and prioritize which vehicles they spend time developing? And the short answer is, yeah, we've seen evidence. I mean, since 1990, California, you know, they first enacted this ZEV mandate. And there's some research that, you know, even back in those days, with just the one state doing the policy, there was a substantial uptick in patent activity, innovation activity, you know, number of prototypes for electric vehicles just from California putting that policy into place. And now you have, well, you have California, you have the other Zed states that have gone along, you have Quebec and British Columbia up in Canada doing the same thing, and China as well, it's a pretty big market that has gone ahead and enacted their own version of a Zed mandate.
Now, Bloomberg New Energy Finance forecast that passenger electric vehicles will account for 52% of the total U.S. passenger vehicles by 2035 and 61% by 2040. Does that sound about right to you?
To me, the big question is it's all about policy. So a lot of these studies, they'll just look at the financial costs. So they'll do projections of, you know, what battery prices have been doing in particular and how quickly they've been going down. And then they'll often do a forward projection and say, okay, at what point does a reasonable battery electric vehicle become, you know, have the same purchase price essentially as a conventional vehicle. And so sometimes sometimes they'll only look at that number and say, okay, well, you know, so by that year, 2030, 2035, that's when there'll be a, you know, an even split or a dead heat competition between the conventional vehicles and electric. But really behind all the scenes are all the policies in place, right? Because you look across North America, across Europe, across the world, there's a patchwork of these policies, both on the demand side. You know, you get these purchase incentives that might be worth $5,000 to $10,000 for the purchase of a vehicle. You have these, charger deployments, making it easier to charge at home or to have fast chargers elsewhere, high occupancy lane vehicle access, you know, all these kinds of policies on the demand side. And then even more hard to really fathom or get understanding of is the supply side. So, you know, does the region have a ZEV mandate or not, which puts a lot of pressure on the automakers to, you know, to make, market, and sell zero emissions vehicles in that jurisdiction. So to me, those market shares that you just quoted from Bloomberg, are they possible? You know, for sure. You know, we know that the world's leading jurisdiction for ZEV sales is Norway, and they've already, you know, been exceeding 50% market share for quite some time. And that's in a cold climate and, you know, all these other kind of things. So it's possible. But as to whether it will happen or not, I would say we would need stronger policy than today in order to get to those 50, 60% market shares you mentioned.
Well, it would seem that we're going in that direction. Electric vehicle stocks just today are even more attractive to Wall Street under President Joe Biden, who has made these climate change issues a priority of his administration. What do you think will happen in the U.S.? What are you hearing about CAFE standards, about cash for clunkers? That was something that was done in the Obama administration. Tax credits, infrastructure. We know that Pete Buttigieg is going to be the new head of the Department of Transportation, and he's been talking up all of these issues. So in the policy arena, does it seem clear that it's going to be moving in that direction?
Yeah, for sure. I would say, in the Obama administration, of course, there was a lot of, let's say, certainty put forth that there was going to be more emphasis on climate change and thus more investment in technologies that go that way. Of course, with Trump, there's a lot of uncertainty. That's really what happened is that, you know, suddenly all the different industry and stakeholders are wondering, well, you know, what are we going to have to comply with or not? But yeah, so certainly with Biden coming in, you know, Biden has been very clear that climate change will be important again. Paris Agreement targets will be important again. And so just that effect, that's exactly what you're seeing in the stocks, right? That's a transformative signal from policy or the precursor of policy, right? It's just stakeholders saying, oh, yeah, I think we're actually going to keep transitioning that way. In terms of which policies, you know, we'll see. I've seen a lot of talk in particular about the vehicle emission standard or the CAFE standards in the U.S. So these have been in place since the 70s, right, of requiring the fuel economy of vehicles to increase year after year. Although, yes, you know, there was certainly some decades in there where there weren't any improvements in fuel economy. But, Obama had ratcheted those policies up. Trump then was trying to freeze those policies to not require any further improvements. And Biden has been quite open that he wants to sustain the original policies, which means that new cars year after year will get more and more efficient up until 2025. But then it sounds like his intention is to use that policy mechanism to further ratchet up improvements going all the way out to, you know, Paris Agreement targets, 2030, 2040. It is a pretty straightforward policy of just saying, you know, if you're going to sell vehicles in the U.S., a given company, you know, the average emissions of a vehicle that you sell, you know, grams per mile, you know, that might have to go down year after year to essentially come down to zero, you know, in the long run. And so that could be complied with through, you know, through initially hybrid vehicles or efficient vehicles like that. Or eventually it'll have to be, you know, electric vehicles or potentially hydrogen vehicles if those really make a serious appearance. But it sounds like that's the mechanism that Biden will be going for.
There was an article a while back in the Wall Street Journal, for electric cars, California needs a bigger grid. And they were talking about the electricity needs in California could raise power demand by as much as 25%. That poses a major challenge for a state already facing periodic rolling blackouts. Do you agree with that? Because I also read where California is getting, at the same time, a bit more efficient with its use of electricity.
Yeah, you got to be careful of all these studies. So I often categorize them between those, let's say not studies, but thinkers, forward-looking thinkers. Are they being static-minded or are they being more dynamic-minded? And so there's a lot of this kind of research that I would call more static. That is, they're kind of just taking a snapshot of today and then changing one thing and saying, okay, there's going to be a problem. Right. And so this is like, yeah, so you take the current grid, you throw, you know, a couple million more electric vehicles or more on there. Okay, there's problems, right? But as I think you're kind of pointing out with this other study, is that really all these systems evolve together, right? I mean, we in all these different countries have adapted to all sorts of developments of energy uses. I mean, the whole idea of having air conditioning everywhere, that wasn't always the case. It became the case. It's had some impacts on the grid, but we figured it out. And also the other, you know, silly things, arguably silly things that humans have figured out to do with energy, you know, more hot tubs and saunas and whatever else. And so, yeah, electric vehicles certainly would add load to the grid, but the grid can and will develop because it will be a pretty slow evolution, right? We do, even with these, with California's very ambitious policy, we're talking about a gradual transition over the next 15 years. So from now to 2035, when we presumably we get to 100% market share of electric vehicles in California, but that's only for sales. That's still only about a third to 40% of vehicles on the road that are electric. So that just to give you that there's really decades of a transition to fully electrifying the fleet, which gives lots of time for utilities who, I mean, and utilities are smart. I work with a lot of different electric utilities. They're constantly modeling the future of electric mobility, among other things. They're figuring out ways to optimally manage their grid. And some of the more forward-looking ones are even looking at how you can have a nice complementarity between electric vehicles and renewable electricity. And this is the idea that one of the biggest drawbacks of renewables, so you have wind, you have solar, you know, all that is great. The problem is that they only generate electricity when the wind is blowing and when the sun is shining, and otherwise you need some storage in order to smooth out the provision of electricity to meet demand. But the cool thing about electric vehicles is, for a lot of them, you have them plugged in for more time than they need to charge. So, you know, vehicle grid integration, it's called. There's been a lot of research on how beneficial this can be. That you can, if the utility can work with consumers either through some, you know, incentives or however it's set up, they can time the charging of these vehicles to coincide with, you know, doing more of it when the wind is blowing, when the sun is shining, and so on, to make more effective use of those renewable forms of electricity. Whereas in present day, often a lot of that wind, you know, for example, has to be dumped off the market in order to balance things out. So, yeah, so all this is from more that dynamic perspective on the coevolution of the grid and vehicles. And I would say, you know, really there's, you know, I wouldn't be worried about a huge explosion of demand that just can't be met.
What about the ability to send a lot of that power that's being generated or put into your car, and you say the excess, back onto the grid?
Oh, right. So the idea that's kind of a next step, as if essentially if you have like a vehicle, you don't need to use all the battery capacity. And so, you know, let's say you don't even need your vehicle all week. you could have it essentially, doing some arbitrage for you, right? Just like working for the utility, storing, working as a remote battery, storing electricity when the wind is blowing and sun is shining and such, and selling it back at a premium. And certainly, yeah, I mean, I've seen plenty of studies on that too. And that, if done right, that could be yet another incentive essentially for consumers to choose to want to buy such a vehicle, because they could actually be this additional source of revenue in that way.
Yeah, you don't need somebody in your house renting a room. You can just kind of rent out the extra capacity of your car. It's a lot less intrusive. Let me ask you about this. I think a lot of people wonder about battery technology. And it's been one of those bugaboos over the years that until we really figure out how to make a better battery that can last longer, have a greater charge, that, we're going to be, falling short in various areas where we really want to use batteries more than we do fossil fuel. Tell us where we are today generally with battery capacity and what these electric car vehicle automakers, and we can talk about that too, because I'm wondering how much of the regular group that we know is going to be dominant in this sphere versus others, but we'll get to that after.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I've been following batteries for a while. Actually, for a while, it was one of my most cited reports was looking at, just for a layperson, what was the state of battery technology, this is 12 years ago now. But really, there's been lots of progress, but I think a lot of the challenges remain the same. And it is trying to develop a battery that scores on all the attributes, right? You want good power density, you want good energy density, but you want low cost, but you also want stability and longevity and safety and all that kind of stuff. So with all that in mind, that's why you don't want to just look at one factor. A lot of the industry reports, as I mentioned before, we'll just look at, just the price, dollars per kilowatt hour is kind of a similar metric. But, and then you'll get these wild numbers for new chemistry, battery chemistries with these, very low dollar per kilowatt hour. But of course, you don't just want the cheapest thing in an automotive application. You need something that's going to work for a very durable good, where it'd be catastrophic to have a huge recall rate for a given battery. So yeah, it is complex. All that said, I mean, there has been quite dramatic improvements, and the proof is really in the pudding. To start with, is just look at the ranges of the vehicles coming to market now, whereas us and researchers were often, simulating these worlds with, one or 200, I was going to say kilometer, but let's say 150 mile range vehicles is kind of the short-term kind of maximum. And then now we're getting, quite easily these 300 mile ranges as kind of the mainstream electric vehicles being sold. So they're definitely getting much better in terms of their, energy density, being able to store lots so you can go a long distance and meet a lot of your, really most of your, annual requirements while still just charging at home, if that's how you're working. And they're getting better in terms of power. I mean, I think Tesla has really, set the world on fire in terms of just being first out the gates to really show how cool an electric car could be. And I give them, pretty much sole credit for changing the consciousness among consumers from thinking of electric vehicles as being these silly little, low performance vehicles to now being something that can be fast and sexy and interesting and so on. So all that said, yeah, I mean, the batteries are definitely looking better and better every year, while the costs do seem to keep going down. And I do think that, that there is a lot of potential for the cost to come down even further in the long run. And again, it just helps really just that we do more of this stuff, have more of these policies. It makes manufacturers, pay attention and to put more and more of their, innovation dollars in this direction. And it's just that's where you see the improvements. You as long as you have lots of R&D happening, then you have more likelihood of reductions in costs and improvements in performance, and then more people buying the vehicles, more experience, and you get this positive feedback loop, which we've only really started.
Looking at having a $25,000 model ready by 2023, they are already more valuable, Professor Axon, than Toyota, Volkswagen, GM, and Ford combined. How is that possible?
Yeah, I would say the possibility, the feasibility of that is beyond academics, I'll tell you that. I mean, having done this work, let's say seriously for 15 years myself, since 2005, And I just kind of started to see the early years of Tesla. And when I was working in California, I got to, you know, have some presentations from their researchers, or their workers, about their initial Roadster. And really back then, you know, that's back when I was looking at battery technology more closely too. And I didn't think any of this would happen. You know, they seemed kind of reckless. Elon Musk had making promises that didn't match up with what any of us thought was possible. The battery chemistry for their first Roadster was no better than the laptop batteries. I mean, it was the same, a lithium cobalt oxide battery, which were being banned from airplanes at the time, right, was powering the Roadster. So, you know, that's just a fire waiting to happen. But somehow over all these years, Elon Musk has been able to not only keep on going, but keep on, you know, more or less making his goals come true. You know, sometimes delayed by a little bit, but he keeps doing it, and he keeps getting these waiting lists for the next thing. And then, yeah, maybe it's a bit late, and maybe there's some problems, but he just kind of keeps on rolling through. And you know, so yeah, so I've gone from being fairly skeptical to saying, okay, is that what they're saying? Yeah, maybe. You know, the $25,000 vehicle by 2023, sure. You know, that could happen. But here's the one bit I will throw on top of all that, is it relates to my earlier point about it all depends on the policy. So what's kind of neat and sexy about, you know, Tesla and Elon Musk is that it's all in the public consciousness as like, this is just like a free market, innovative, you know, guy. It captures what all of us want to do. This is fantastic. And it's also like as if this is just pure innovation and like I said, a kind of free market. But behind all that is policy. So people rarely talk about this, but Tesla, you know, I would argue, is only still alive today as a company because of the ZEV mandate in California, right? They make a killing off of these credits because that policy requires each automaker that sells in California to sell a certain share of electric vehicles. Tesla sells only electric vehicles, so they over comply by a long shot every year. That gives them extra credits that then they sell to the other automakers that fall short. So you don't know exactly who's selling to who, but you can kind of figure it out that, you know, they're selling to GM, to Ford, and all these given years. And really, I mean, it's if you trace it back, the only quarters that Tesla makes a profit, you can see it's actually, they wouldn't have without those sales of credits under this ZEV mandate policy. Now, all that is to say, that's not a critique at all of the system. I actually say that's exactly what we wanted that kind of policy to do. The ZEV mandate is one example of what I call a transformative policy, where not only does it want to try to help us meet our GHG reduction targets, but it's trying to send a signal to industry, to innovators, that that's where we're going, and provide enough confidence to make it happen. And it since 1990, has set up this environment so that innovators like Tesla can emerge, essentially in this what is an initially protected environment. That is, they won't go under the first year just because they don't make profits, but they can, you know, they can sell credits, they can get by, they can get to the next thing. And I would say, you know, Elon Musk has really emerged as someone who's just excellently exploiting that policy. And exploit can sound like a bad thing, but again, from a climate perspective, we need that. We needed that transformation.
Now, let me ask you, who else is getting the message? GM said that it's going to spend $27 billion through 2025 on electric and driverless cars. And I would love to know what the junction is between electricity and automotive or autonomous vehicles. And then I'm reading about all these other companies I've never heard of, Rivian, Lucid Motors, Lordstown Motors Corporation, Nikola Corporation. Beyond that, of course, there are all these other players that we've heard about in autonomous vehicles, including many of the tech companies. Is there going to be an Apple car? So is there this convergence between autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles?
Yeah, so that is a huge question mark. You know, automated vehicles, I've been following that for a while, and, you know, I'm always the kind of the kind of boring guy who says, you know, who looks at the hype and says, no, you know, that's not going to happen. And usually I'm right. It's pretty easy to kind of be skeptical about these things, other than with Tesla or Elon Musk. But for automation, yeah, I mean, I all of us skeptics have been right. And you can look at all these quotes from the last 10 years of when, you know, each year automakers and different agencies were saying, oh, yeah, we'll have fully automated vehicles by 2012, by 2018, by 2020, you know, and it's, I've already, you know, won some bets with friends about us not being there already. So I think this is an area worthy of skepticism looking forward. I guess the overlap you're asking, or the connection between automation and electric, it's not immediately clear to a lot of us, but I think from an engineering perspective, there is this potential, you know, idea of, well, you know, electric vehicles, you know, one of the challenges of it is that you can't charge it so easily. Well, I mean, what if you had an automated vehicle that could go charge itself, essentially? Mm-hmm. And so you don't have the same spatial requirements or whatever, you know, for charging as you do with a conventional vehicle. And then there's a few other little points like that. I mean, my team has kind of begrudgingly added some of these types of questions into our consumer research surveys, because we kept seeing a few of these like cutting edge experts, let's say more engineering types, who said, oh yeah, automation plus electric, that's great. But then we try to bring it up with consumers, and you know, they don't get it. They don't know why. I mean, they have a hard enough time understanding why they might want an automated vehicle, but then an automated electric vehicle, you know, there's not really enough understanding for there to be a latent demand for this technology that I can see, that we'd be able to see just yet. So, I really still consider the two separate ideas. Like, whereas electric mobility, you know, we've talked about, you know, the technology is pretty much there, right? I mean, if we can have Norway at 50%, we can definitely have most, you know, consumers. So something can be developed to satisfy the needs of most any consumer already with today's technology, and it's just going to get better as we go forward. The automation piece, I think it's really, really a different market, a different, you know, demand reason. It's more like, I mean, it's certainly going to be strong for freight and goods movement. That's just, you know, there's a lot of efficiency gains to save on driver costs there. For individual households, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concerns. A lot of, like, the average household doesn't know, like, do they want a robot car? They don't know. They don't really trust it yet. You know, it's really, like, even if it was free, like when we asked this of our you know, representative samples, it's like, even if it's free, they still said, well, as long as I can still, you know, drive it myself, because I don't know if I'm going to trust that thing.
Let me ask you, as a consumer and having done a lot of research about consumers, I think most consumers want to know, well, what kind of value am I getting? In other words, I buy this, maybe it's a little bit more expensive at the beginning, but maybe my maintenance costs are going to be lower. I'm not certain about insurance or whether there's any differential there. How much will the electricity cost versus gasoline? All of these questions, how do you look at that if somebody's trying to evaluate that even today? Because obviously there are electric cars and hybrid cars on the market. What do you say to people?
So my friends ask me, you know, what if they should buy an electric vehicle or not, right? Yeah, I mean, I'm still very, it's kind of funny. Like, I myself, I don't own an electric vehicle. I've never really bought a new vehicle, so I've never really bought anything in the price range of current vehicles. And yeah, I think some people think that's a bit of hypocrisy, I guess. But the thing is, in my research, I mean, I never say that the world needs to be saved by voluntary switching to electric vehicles. I keep saying it's about policy. And I particularly focus on the need for policies that, like the ones I'm talking about, these you know, focus on automakers and giving them enough signal to change what they develop. Those policies will then provide the incentive, so we'll end up with a broader and broader suite of different types of electric vehicles, something for everyone. You know, for me, it's like, if I can just have a nice little sedan that's a plug-in hybrid, you know, that's reliable, that's what I need. It doesn't really exist in my market yet, but, you know, presumably will in some time. There's plenty of others that just want to have, you know, want to make sure they have the pickup truck or the, you know, the SUV or whatever in their preferred class for hauling kids around or whatever else. And while those vehicles don't really exist yet or they're in short supply, it's like, you can imagine just in 5 years, 10 years, especially if you have a upcoming ban on internal combustion engines, automakers will respond by providing a much greater variety. So, you know, I'm really fine with people, you know, going towards what they want in the market. And I think it's really, we need the policy to make sure the automakers are providing that supply. So all that is to say, when I come down to the individual, I don't say, you know, something like, you owe it to the world. Everyone buys an electric vehicle. If you don't do that, you're being immoral. I will say, you know, like, if that's what you're excited about, if you really want to make a statement about climate change and such, then, you know, that's one reason to go ahead and get whatever thing you can grab onto. But honestly, like, if you can't, if it's not available in the class and segment that you need, then, you know, I would say, you know, I think it's okay to still go ahead with a, you know, getting a reasonably efficient car in the short run. But meanwhile, you know, like keep supporting government and policymakers to put in the policies so that the, you know, the next time you are buying a vehicle, that there will essentially, there'll be the same diversity and variety of electric vehicles of all shapes and sizes and performance levels as we currently have for gas vehicles.
Now, if you're somebody who drives basically around town as opposed to long trips, and range has always been something, at least for the moment, even though it will change dynamically, what about the whole notion of somebody who is a salesman traveling the entire East Coast of the United States versus somebody who stays around town? Would that be one of the considerations? And I think in that context, everybody's wondering, are there going to be enough public charging stations, and who owns those, and how do we know we're getting the best price when we stop in at one? We can shop now for gasoline.
Okay, there's a few layers of questions in there. I mean, trying to zero in on, I guess, like the market segments for travel in terms of who should be attracted to what. I mean, I think you kind of gave the extremes there of someone just driving around town a little bit versus someone who's driving constantly, to, you know, with different overnight destinations potentially. I mean, really, electric vehicles are especially financially attractive to more of a middle segment, for those who are driving a lot, so they can save a lot of money in terms of the gas they're offsetting, but. But, you know, they have a consistent charger at night. So, you know, I was just talking to someone who bought a Nissan Leaf, and I live up in the mountains north of Vancouver, and, you know, they're driving regularly, whatever it would be, I guess 150 miles north for work, and then they come right back, and their Leaf has been great for that. Mm. They're really, you know, they're using their vehicle, they're offsetting a lot of gasoline spending, so they're kind of saving money as part of that, and then they have their reliable home charging, you know, each night. Whereas if you're really just driving a few kilometers around town or a few miles around town every day or a few times a week, which a lot of people are doing in kind of these pandemic scenarios, right? Then it's almost like, well, geez, you know, you just bought this more expensive electric vehicle and it's going to take you forever to pay it back, right? In the sense of if you're concerned about the financial payback kind of feature.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you know, it's gonna work out a bit better for someone who's using their vehicle fairly regularly. Yeah, if you are really, you know, the old school traveling salesman type, then yeah, I think you'd have to be quite adventurous for it to be worthwhile to be solely relying on electric vehicle. And I talked to plenty of folks who are like that. Like they drove across Canada or they drive across the U.S. and they enjoy kind of looking for where the charging opportunities are and figuring out how they can do it. And they can, but it just takes more patience and patience than I have personally. So it kind of depends on what your motivators are. And now around here,
who's going to own those charging stations? Would that be the electric companies wherever we live, or will that be a private concern? Will the oil companies try to get into that, and we'll see a Shell charging station?
Yeah, you know, I think going forward, we'll see kind of what we're already seeing, which is just a blend. You know, you want to have a healthy blend of providers, so you get plenty of support from you know these public chargers where you know, like city governments, you know, will put in these chargers you know where they can, or will provide incentives and make it easier for private providers to put them in, and so yeah, I think, I mean, really it's ideal to have both, because you know if you're trying to have a broad ecosystem, I guess is the way you look at it. Mm-hmm. You want to have as much help, or, you know, like self-interest working for everybody with the private market providing these things, so you get more and more of them. But at the same time, the free market doesn't necessarily do a great job when it comes to what you call network effects, when you have kind of these spatial inequalities. And so you would want to have, in the short run at least, public providers to fill in some of those gaps. And again, that is already happening in most of North America. But even more important, I think is what we keep seeing again and again is while the public charging or the destination charging is a helpful bonus, really it's having a reliable home charger that is most important for the majority of consumers. So that works out great if you have a garage, but there needs to be more work to make sure that those living in the multifamily units and the apartments and condos and such are able to have the same kind of reliability.
And will we have to go from 110-volt wall outlet to 240, most of us?
Yeah, well, again, it depends on the type of vehicle you have. I mean, the 220, 240 can certainly be certainly faster and is ideal. But, we've been talking mostly about electric vehicles in general. I'm talking about, just pure electric vehicles. But I haven't really talked as much about plug-in hybrid vehicles. We're talking about, what the Chevrolet Volt was and a few of these other ones that really, they have both the battery that's charged up from the grid, but they still have the gasoline engine. And we actually find there's a lot more interest among mainstream consumers in having a plug-in hybrid vehicle. While at the same time, the evidence so far is that most of these vehicles are driven mostly electric. You kind of get this win where you are getting a lot of the climate benefit, but potentially reaching a bigger market segment. And the other bonus is that, these are typically are smaller batteries, and so it can be feasible to charge them overnight with a regular 110 volt. So it means you can be more flexible. It's like my sister has a Chevrolet Volt, and if she comes to visit me, then she can just plug in, on my regular outlet outside, no problem. So again, it depends on what you're trying to do. But if you have a big battery Tesla or the Nissan Leaf going, 300 miles or whatever, then you're going to want 240 volt charging at home for sure.
Okay, now let me close with this. You've been so great. And you've talked, of course, about the importance of public policy in all of this development. What electric vehicle incentives are you looking for? And, for example, you mentioned just now the hybrid. Would that be something that would be discontinued as part of what California is looking at? Do they want total or will they allow partial? And what other incentives do you want to see at least moving, even if it's gradually, toward a full electric future?
Yeah, well, I mean, if I haven't been clear already, I mean, I really think, anywhere that's serious about this has a policy mix. So you need a suite of complementary policies to make sure we're going to make our climate targets for transportation. And the research that we've done, just examining all the studies, there's quite a lot of evidence that the heavy hitters in that policy mix need to be the regulations. And so what I've already talked about, a vehicle emission standard, CAFE standards, like Biden is planning to ramp up zero emissions vehicle sales mandates like California's had, or conversely, an internal combustion engine ban, because all of that sends a signal to automakers that they have to, make sure that they sell these vehicles, make sure that they get out there. Then on the what I would call the incentive side, that's more when government, kind of steps in and directly tries to help out the consumer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think as much as the governments have the funding to do so, I mean, having these, $5,000, $10,000 purchase incentives are great. They definitely make the vehicle much more appealing. And they're more politically acceptable in this kind of hidden way, is that the automakers who are under all these regulations and are then being required to sell electric vehicles, they typically complain about those regulations, as you understand. But if the government is helping out by incentivizing financially the purchase, then that can buy some more political acceptance from automakers as well. So it can be a good reason in that way to have government kind of help out the automakers, at least for a couple of years while we're transitioning towards lower cost batteries and so on. And ideally in the long run, I mean, you don't want to have, a whole decade or 20 years of government handing out $5,000 of taxpayer dollars for electric vehicles. I don't think that's going to, I mean, we'd rather have education and health and, better infrastructure and better transit and everything. There's as many opportunity costs for all of that. So I think the hope would be that these incentives would be more short term, part of a transition, whereas the regulations, like I said, could really do the heavy lifting to get us to our climate targets.
Now, I did mention that John Axon is an associate professor at Simon Fraser University. I didn't mention that he's also the director of the Sustainable Transportation Research Team called START. And you've mentioned a number of these studies that you've done. If people want to get access to your work, how can they best do that?
Yeah, well, they can look at my webpage at Simon Fraser University. We have all the studies are posted there, or alternatively, the START website that you mentioned would also be a good source. So hopefully you can post a link to that for this podcast.
Okay.
And if anyone, I mean, a lot of the work we do both publicly accessible stuff as well as some of the peer reviewed stuff, and the peer reviewed stuff sometimes you require a subscription to access it, but we are allowed to help out people individually if they contact us. So our emails are also quite accessible, and so we can get you a key report if you're interested.
Okay, that's great.
Journal article.
And let me just spell your name, J-O-N-N, and then the last name is A-X-S-E-N. If you're looking for it, Simon Fraser University, FRASERSFU. I thank you so much for being with us today and walking through an area that I think a lot of us are fascinated by, but we have our questions, and you've answered so many of them today on America Trends. Thanks again, John.
Well, thanks for the time, Larry. It's a great talking to you.